Hello, good to see you all. My name's Lucian Wishick. I'm the spec lead for Visual Basic. That means I'm kind of in charge of the language. I run the language design meetings. And also, because now we have this policy of co-evolution between Visual Basic and C#, it means I'm part of the C# language design meetings. Just to set expectations, this is a 400-level talk. I called it a masterclass. Strap on your seatbelt. I really wanted to do advanced language features. One of the really neat things about Visual Basic is, did you know that some version of Visual Basic, either VBA or .NET or VB6 or all of them, is the primary programming language used by some 17% of the world's programmers? That's a heck of a lot. I found this. This one isn't quite Visual Basic. Someone forwarded it to me. It's from a classroom in Kyrgyzstan. I don't know how many of you can read Cyrillic. The letter at the top, it really does say basic, and the next word is tili, and the line 10, rem quadratike teoreme, or something like that. It's a quadratic. They'd painted this on the classroom wall to help the students understand what was happening. Actually, there's a bug in it. It doesn't check for a divide by zero condition. And also, I look at this one, line 40. If D is above or equal to zero, then 70. That was shorthand in some dialects of BASIC for go to line 70. Now the go to is required. Before getting on to the technical stuff, I wanted to talk about this Microsoft policy of co-evolution. We announced it a year and a bit ago. This is the first product release that it's gone into effect. What co-evolution means is that whenever you guys invest in Visual Basic, your investment is safe. Visual Basic is not going away. Every new major language feature that supports a new language or a new framework or a new API or some kind of library, if it's accessible from VB, it will be accessible from C# and vice versa. That means that really, this is the promise that we're not going to be left behind in the cold for putting Visual Basic nowadays, which had been the worry of customers. And it's a kind of weird strategy. Like, normally when you buy detergents from the supermarket, you're not going to find Procter and whatever. You're not going to find them selling one detergent with these features and another detergent with almost identical features but in a different color. No, whenever you go to branding 101 or marketing lesson, they tell you differentiate your products. Well, Microsoft and Visual Studio languages are not doing that for Visual Basic and C#. Okay, they have a slightly different feel to them, and they have a different syntax and a different look, but really, we're putting the same things into both languages. Scott Wiltermuth is the head of Visual Studio Languages. This is his blog post where he outlined this policy. I have to say, we're doing a good job on the language front, and we're doing a good job on the samples front. We made a major effort this past year to make sure we have parity. All of the samples that were C# only now have VB as well. We haven't done such a good job internally within Microsoft of telling our product divisions to do a pretty good mixture, and we're working on that. At the moment, we have parts of Visual Studio, mainly the property dialogues, the designers, written in Visual Basic, other parts written in C#, most of it's written in C++. And what we're undertaking at the moment is a major effort to rewrite the Visual Basic compiler in Visual Basic, rewrite the C# compiler in C#. That will be our main internal customer of Visual Basic in the coming year. But I'm a VB, and I'm proud of it. I thought I'd just start by telling you a bit about the cool things that I'm proud of. New features in Visual Studio 2010, array literals. I'm assuming you're an expert audience, and you know mostly about what's happening here. Using reflection and system.type, we're finding all of the constructors that take zero parameters, and then, in fact, we're finding the first one, and then we're invoking it, and we're passing zero parameters. We're passing this empty array. Can I just have a show of hands? How many of you have taken Visual Studio 2010 out for a spin? A few, not many. Okay, good. So a lot of you will benefit from seeing what some of the new features are. The C-sharp equivalent, it doesn't have such a nice array syntax. You either specify the type of the array and how big it is, or you specify the type and provide it with an empty initializer list. So VB is doing something quite special here. It's figuring out the context of the get constructor call, provides a type context, telling it what type of array it's expecting, and it infers what type this array literal stands for based on the context. F sharp. How many of you have tried using F sharp? Zero hands. That's pretty poor. I mean, I'm in VB, but I really advise you to try F sharp. Lots of the features from functional languages have already made their way into VB and C sharp, lambdas especially, and it's going to happen more. One of the other big features that is nice in F sharp is that read-only data structures are just so easy, immutable data structures are so easily and natural to write, and that's one of the directions that C sharp and VB will probably be taking in the next coming release. If you start using F sharp now, I think you'll have 1 or 2 years head start on everyone else, so please give it a go. Anyway, F sharp touted as Microsoft's great, elegant, simple syntax. It has this weird construct for creating arrays. And I'll give them credit. They're almost as nice as Visual Basic in this case. So I'm a VB and I'm proud of it. Here's another place where I'm proud. Dim X as new list of string. Okay, it's a list of string. And we figure, Anders was talking about this yesterday, co and contravariance. We figure a string is also an object. Therefore, a list of string, we should be able to convert that to a list of object. And if we try it, it has the double the squiggly underline on it saying, error, list of string cannot be converted to list of object. Okay, so co and contravariance is a difficult topic to get right. Really, I think you teach it to first-year PhD students. We had trouble at Microsoft when we were implementing this feature. It just kind of makes your brain explode because you get confused with it. We figured out a solution. We got these kaleidoscope goggles, and we did it in pair programming. One of us sits here looking at the screen. The guy next to him keeps his eyes shut and types away, and that way neither person's brain got overloaded properly, and we didn't have any exploding brains. But we got there in the end. And I'll tell you what Visual Basic is doing here. Contravariance doesn't quite work in this case, but it says consider using IEnumerable of object instead of list of object. Okay, this is the VB tradition, that even without having this PhD in contravariance, the compiler is still giving a human readable explanation of what went wrong and how to fix it. And indeed, if we change this to say dim y as IEnumerable of object, it will work. We haven't had to understand why, but we got it to work. The C-sharp thing, it has the same error message, but it doesn't kind of have the Visual Basic spirit of telling you how to fix it up and where to go. There's one other place where I'm really proud to be a VB, and I love this. I've been writing web services myself. I haven't been using ASP or any framework. I figured out when you dig down to the root of it, a web service is just a console mode program which outputs something to standard output. It outputs the first line, which is content type, then it outputs a blank line, and then it outputs the body of it. And why I love VB is for the XML literals. I've been going crazy on XML literals recently. In this case, I put this fragment of XML, actually it's HTML, I guess you could call it XHTML, directly into my VB program, and I embedded a part of a link query inside the XML, and then I embedded XML inside the link query, and then I embedded VB inside the link query, inside the XML. Okay, so it's a beautiful way of combining XHTML and code. I used to do my web services in PHP, but this has become an easier way of writing web services, more elegant. Are you guys using XML literals in your code? Hands up if you're using XML literals. About half of you. I read this funny saying recently. It was from an US Army briefing from some programmer division to the generals, and they explained XML is like violence. If it's not working for you yet, you're not using enough of it. Well, that's... And this XML stuff has already been there in Visual Studio 2008. That was just an overview. Now I wanted to get into some brain teasers and some difficult bits. Here's a piece of code. Do you all know about nullables? Hands up if you know about nullables. Everyone, good. So this is the right audience. What is this program going to print? There are two possibilities. It might pass the if test and print is nothing, or it might fail the if test and not print anything at all. Shout out, what's it going to do? Sorry? Is nothing. I ran it. It didn't print anything at all. That's quite confusing, right? We get bugs coming into us saying, you have an error in your product. This code should print something and it doesn't print anything. And we answer that it's by design, but it's by design for a weird reason. And actually, this demo here is in Visual Studio 2008. I'm going to switch to 2010 now to show you what we've done about it. Let's put in the same code. Okay, so we've introduced a warning message for this particular code. I'll hover over it. It says, this expression will always evaluate to nothing due to null propagation from the equals operator. To check if the value is null, consider using is nothing. Blah, 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 gobbledygook. I'm not going to bother understanding what it says. I'm just going to do what it says. Is nothing. The warning goes away. And I run it. And it now prints is nothing, like I expected. Okay, so something's going on here. What's going on here is called null propagation. And I wanted to just go over this to say what's happening. So we know nullable means it can either have a value or not have a value. And not having a value means I don't know what this value is. So here, 5 has a value, and I'm trying to do 5, an integer 5, plus an integer which I don't know what this integer is. And what's the answer? If you do 5 plus I don't know what, the answer is I don't know what. If we do 5 multiplied by I don't know what, then the answer is I don't know what the answer is. So in both of these cases, it should print false. It should print false because I do not know what the answer is. And I'll run it, and it prints false. Okay, that's doing the right thing. And with that, we can go back to understand what the problem was here. X was a Boolean question mark. X was either true or false, or I don't know what it was. And nothing is a Boolean value which I don't know what it was. And if you're saying, does I don't know what it is equal I don't know what it is, the answer is, I don't know. And so you ask, if I don't know, then console.writeline is nothing. And we don't know if that's true, so we just don't print it. That's the way Visual Basic works. Actually, C-sharp doesn't work this way in this particular respect. Why doesn't it work this way? It's because VB is a more mathematically pure language in this case. And I'll tell you why this comes about. It's from Eric Meyer, a fellow Dutchman, came to Microsoft, and he's been a big influence on Visual Basic. He comes from an academic background, so he's all keen on mathematical purity. And he talks about lifted operators. A lifted operator means we've got the normal operators, plus, times, divide, equals, doesn't equal. And once we get nullables, then we will lift every single operator into a nullable form of the operator. So we normally had the plus operator, we lift it into a nullable form of the plus operator, and these lifted operators work exactly the same in all respects. If either of their arguments was nothing, then the answer is nothing. So that's a beautiful, pure, clean, mathematicians-inspired way of designing a programming language. It's not quite how most programmers expect it to behave. And what happens here is that C-sharp made the compromise for the sake of regular programmers, and C-sharp did the equals for Booleans case differently from every other case, just to make this one easier. VB stuck with its purity. Eric Meyer is a fantastic guy. He's gone crazy now on something called iObservable. This is a nicer way of doing asynchronous programming. If you ever get a chance to see him give a talk on iObservable, definitely go to the talk. What he does, iObservable is a way of responding to events. So it's really good for when you're writing web pages that have to respond to events. Anyway, he gets a big pot of money. He calls for a volunteer from the audience. If ever he asks for a volunteer, stick your hand up. Then what he'll do is he'll stay there and he starts throwing you the coins to see how many you can collect. This is to represent. I'm not going to tell you what it represents. When you go to his talk, you can see. But the long and short is you'll get free money if you go to a talk by Eric Meyer. Oops. So I've just made sure that you all understand what nullable is about. And here's the actual customer bug that we got. I have a property called access level, which I just defined here. And what we tried to do here in this code snippet is like normal in the setter of a property, we only want to raise the notify event, or we only want to act on a property change if it has actually changed. We don't want to do anything if we assigned the same value to it. So when you do this a second time, it should only print that it's changed once, right? It only prints that it's changed once. Okay, so here we set it to 15, then we set it to nothing, and we print access level. Okay, all of you already know, since I've been talking about nullables and the problem with nullables, that there's going to be a problem here. Let's just run it to see what this problem is. It changed once, but it didn't change the second time. Well, we know there's a bug. And we see the question mark, so straight away we think something to do with nullables, and then we have to start working through it. Tell me how I should change it, actually. Anyone? Just shout out, please. Yeah? I'm sorry, change which thing? This one here. No. This one. Well, That doesn't work, because this is testing something quite different. The is operator is testing for reference equality. It's not testing whether the actual value has changed. Sorry? Okay. So let's write it out in full. So you said check the value rather than that thing. And just, we should really protect it properly. If access level.hasValue is different from value.hasValue, or else if they both have a value, okay, we've spelt it out. We've said if whether or not they have a value is different, or if they both have a value and they have a different value, so yeah, we're sticking into the value, then we'll print it. I should really prepare the correct answer as a snippet rather than... Okay, it worked. It worked correctly. It changed twice and it printed nothing. Okay, so there we have it that... that nullables get confusing when you compare them with equality and, you know, what kind of problem to look for. This is an interesting statement in its own right, you know. Question, what is the type of this expression nothing? Anyone? Sorry. Sorry? Object. Yeah, and when I hover over it, it says object. That's not actually true, because we're not allowed to assign an object to this thing. I mean, if I had dimt as object equals nothing, access level equals t, this is an error with options strict on, but this thing is not an error with options strict on. And that tells us that nothing is different from object. What nothing is nothing is merely the default value of the target type, where the target type is known from the context. So in this case, it said the target type is an integer question mark, therefore nothing will be the default value of integer question mark, the default value of nullable of integer. And that's not an object. It's not even a reference, because nullable of integer is a structure. Instead, it's just the default value of that structure. If you're writing it in C#, this would be equivalent to saying That's exactly what nothing is doing. So nothing is quite special. Nothing is an expression whose meaning depends on the target context. And you've already seen another one that does that. You saw array literals also took their meaning depending on the target context. And that's now become quite an important feature for Visual Basic, with lambdas at the other place. And here, let's stick out the cases where it happens. I like to think of this as quantum superposition. I know nothing about quantum mechanics, but what I do know is that quantum superposition was the idea that an electron, a particle can have one spin and another spin at the same time, or the cat, Schrödinger's cat, can be alive and dead at the same time. It sort of entertains all of the possibilities at the same time. And we're doing something like that here. Dim B0 equals nothing. There is no target type to tell it what to be, so it assumes B0 is an object. Dim B1 as integer, here it does have a target type, So it assumes that nothing is the default integer, and the default integer is zero. Can we assign an object to an integer? No, we can't, obviously, because an integer is a structure. It's not a reference type. Okay. Yeah. It prints zero. Okay, so let's try this. It prints zero pretty much like we expected. The late binder, when it turns the null reference into an integer, turns it into zero. And it works with integer question mark. Yeah, that's correct. There was one case at the edge of my mind where nullables don't work in the late bound scenario. That's why I'm scared of it. But I can't remember what it is at the moment. I totally believe you. We have this trouble, actually, you know. I mean, there are... Like I say, some form of Visual Basic used by 17% of the world's programmers as their primary language. And there are a heck of a lot of code samples out there that are written in non-option strict mode. And certainly if we started creating the file new project template that defaulted to that mode, then whenever people copy and paste, when beginners copy and paste from the internet, they'll find errors that they don't know what to do. So we understand there's a problem, and we understand that it's desirable, but the thing... This is all very speculative, by the way, but what we've been talking about for future version of Visual Basic is to be awesome if we could have some kind of strict mode for the new platforms. Because, like, when you're writing for Windows Mobile 7 or Silverlight or XNA, these things are not going to be legacy platforms. People are writing new paradigms, and they're writing new things. What we hope to do, this is all speculative, no promises at all, is get rid of Microsoft.visualbasic.dll, instead inline the tiny parts of it into your executable that are needed, maybe expand it by 15K, and default projects in this new mode for these new platforms into the option strict on mode. We'll see if that works, and that would be a good default for new projects, but we're not there yet. And actually, let's leave it on just to watch these happen. We talked about superposition types. Address of is another one. Question, what is the type of an address of? And the answer is, address of does not have any type at all. Address of, in order to understand address of, it depends totally on the target type. Here I said the target type is action. And that helps us work with this. The question is, what on earth is going on here? Why doesn't address of have a type, but it does succeed in the context of a target type that we know? And the reason is, if I wrote two overloads of the main function, and someone wrote address of main, the compiler would have no idea which one you were talking about. The only way it can know which one you're talking about is if you tell it which one you're talking about by providing the target context. Okay, that seems a bit esoteric. Let's get on to the place where you're going to be running into these issues every single day. We said that B1 was an integer. We declared it as an integer up here. And we declare C0 to be an array of B1. In other words, C0 will be an array of integers, yeah? I could make it an array of object containing B1. Now, something special has gone on here. It's impossible to turn an array of integer into an array of object. Why is that? That's because how .NET works. An array of integer, I mean, when you look at it in memory, it's represented as an array of D words or however big an integer is. Each one occupies a certain number of bytes. An array of object is represented as a sequence of memory addresses. Each one is garbage collected and so on. And there's no way that this block of memory can be interpreted like this block of memory. They're just completely different. That's why the .NET runtime does not allow you to convert one into the other. So something special is going on here. And what's going on special is that it's interpreting each element according to the target type of the context. Now, that sounds kind of weird. Good question. And I'm going to answer it in a moment. I want to explore down this avenue just a bit further and we'll get to it. Obviously, in this case, the type of queue is an array of integers because I put some integers inside it. If I put a double, what do you think will be the type of queue here? Shout it out. It'll be a double array. So what it's doing here is it said dominant type. Dominant type is a concept that already existed from type inference in 2008, but it's being used here more. Dominant type says, I will look at these and I'll find, well, an integer can be converted to a double, therefore double is a good candidate, but a double cannot be converted to an integer, therefore integer is not a good candidate. This is an error with option strict on. Cannot infer an element type because more than one type is possible. Specifying the type of the array might correct this error. And if I turned option strict off, it compiles clean. With option strict off, what does it pick? It picks object array. And that's correct because all of these can be converted to object. And how is it converting to object? Well, when it finds the array literal, first it figures out the type of the dominant type of the elements. Then it uses normal VB assignment, just normal VB assignment. And you can always assign an integer to an object, and that assignment will do boxing. So it's using normal assignment to assign each element of the array. And after it's done that, then it has an array of the correct type. Sorry, it's using normal assignment to assign an integer 1 to an object element. It's using double 2.5 to assign to an object element, a string to an object element. So all of that works fine. That's where the boxing happens. And the general principle is here that it's not nice to infer object. If we infer object and we have something that's an object, then IntelliSense stops working and you start getting late-bound behavior. So what we said is that when option strict is on, we will not infer object, and that's why the error is happening in this case. Okay, we got a bit esoteric there with superposition. Let's get back into arrays and new features. Why am I telling you all this? It's because I started with nothing, because that really throws people for a loop. 99% of people do not realize that nothing means default of target type in Visual Basic. That does lead to bugs. It's led to bugs in our own code. I started by showing you that new warning that we introduced in 2010. So we recognize that it's a problem. We're not going to change the meaning of the language. We can't change the meaning of existing programs, but we're adding warnings just to help you in the common cases. I showed you the more difficult example with access level. We haven't figured out how to add warnings about people misunderstanding nothing in all cases. And if any of you guys have ideas on how we can detect the warning situations, I'm all ears. I would love to hear them. And I talked about dominant type because that's important with lambdas, it's important with address of, and now it's important with array literals. This is a collection initializer. This is a new feature in 2010. It's not an array literal. Dim x as new list of string from. This is the new keyword in this context. From. Dot, dot. It's provided a list of initializers for this list of string. And this is exactly equivalent to creating a list of string and then calling x.add of 1. X dot add of 2, X dot add of 3. Okay, that's what the collection initializer feature is about. That's an error, of course, but I'm going to show you something cute. Actually, this is a really poorly motivated example. I'm going to start with something different. As new dictionary of string, comma, integer. That's an error, of course, because you just can't add. There is no overloaded method for add in dictionary that takes one argument. It expected key, comma, value. Okay, so if I provided key, comma, value, then it would work correctly. This is the new feature, collection initializers. It's a great way to initialize a list. I'm going to show you something kind of exciting to do with this that I recommend that you start using in your APIs because it will make things easier. Let's make a okay, that works now. Why does it work? It works because I was allowed to write x.add of 2 using this new extension method that I created. It's kind of weird to do in this case. But what I've done is, using extension methods, I've been able to completely subvert the meaning of the collection initializer. The collection initializer now works with any set of arguments. Well, any set of arguments that I cared to support. Why would we use this? We'd use this in cases where we believe that collection initializers are a nice way of initializing data, and they are a nice way of initializing data, but we just want to provide a lot more flexibility with the contents of what we provide to the add method. This is a dry example. Let's give a real example. Let's suppose I had a class student, it has a string and let's suppose that this were actually a list of student. Fred scored 1, Jones scored 15, and Kurt scored 3, scored 20. And let's change my method. It's going to take a... Okay, first, this is an error. Why is it an error? It's because there's no method of add that takes this. If I wanted to do this, I'd have to write new student with name equals Fred... And we think that's really verbose. I don't want to write that every single time. So instead, I'm going to do it this way. This dot add of new student with dot name equals key dot score equals score. Okay, and there we have it. What we've done is we've used an extension add method to make collection initializers a heck of a lot more beautiful. Hey, did you notice the other thing that's new in 2010 here? There are no more underscores. I used to hate these. You had to write them all over the place. And now we don't have to. We can delete them all. Oh, that's a brilliant feature.
What's the scope of this extension?
This extension method. Extension methods go inside modules, and they are visible to anyone who has visibility inside that module. So if I wrote another class up here, then it works in there. And that's because the module is a peer of the class, therefore it can look inside its contents. And if we had a module inside another DLL and we reference the assembly, then it would work the same. Where were we? I don't have any internet access. Okay, so that was a bit of a detour into collection initializers and how you should be using the add extension method. I just thought I'd play around with another feature here. You heard Anders yesterday talk about one of the futures of programming as being immutable. We really believe that strongly. Again, for the next release, everything's completely speculative, but my money is on the idea that we'll do something with fixed data collections. Maybe change the framework to, so we don't just have list and dictionary, instead we'll have something like fixed list and fixed dictionary. Maybe also adding syntax into the language to make it easier to write immutable collections. And actually, now that we're rewriting Visual Basic inside Basic itself, we're using immutable stuff all of the time in our coding. Immutable is really important for parallel programming. I mean, if one thread creates a complex data structure and it passes it off to another thread, it has two choices. It can either guarantee that it's immutable so that the other thread doesn't change it, or it can pessimistically make a copy and pass it off to the other thread just in case the other thread changes it. And that's a complete disaster. We don't want that. So we're using immutable data throughout our work. Here, I sort of jumped the gun. I've decided to start using immutable data collections in my own work. And I thought, how can I do this with as beautiful a syntax as possible? I'm thinking of Python here, actually. I mean, Python has the nicest syntax ever. And I thought, can we get as nice as Python in Visual Basic? And the answer is yes. Dim x as fixed list of string. This is a class I created, which is going to be an immutable list. And I initialized it like this. What's it doing? Well, this is an array literal. It's not a collection initializer because it doesn't have the from keyword. It's an array initializer. And of course, we know what the type of this array initializer will be. It will be an array of string. And so I just wrote a widening operator C type, which takes a string array and it produces a fixed list. And I'm making a fixed list by passing it to the constructor. I really reckon this is a beautiful piece. I want to show you something quite weird, actually. Now, one, two, three. Sorry, I should have left that up for a moment. What I did was I made this list of integers, and then I tried to print out element 2, which was 3 because off by 1. What on earth is happening here? How did it convert an array of strings into this fixed list of integer? Can anyone tell me? I told you this would be an advanced class. Let's have a clue. Option strict on, it doesn't work. Disallows implicit conversions from one-dimensional array of string to a fixed list of integer. But when we had option strict off, what was it doing? Well, it had this array literal. Remember, an array literal doesn't always have its own type. Instead, it can take its type from the surrounding context. In this case, the surrounding context was a cast operator. The cast operator takes a T array. In this case, it takes an integer array. And then Visual Basic asked, can I create this array literal inside? Can I use this string array literal to create an integer array? And in turn, it asked for element number 1, can I write this? And the answer is, in all of these cases, it can do that with option strict off, but it can't do it with option strict on. That's what was happening. This sounds really stupid, and what's going on in your head, I hope, is, this is stupid. Why do I care about option strict off? I don't want option strict off. I want option strict on. So let's give a better example. As fixed list of question, what is the type of T? It's a constructor info. What is the type of Y? It's a fixed list of member info. Imagine if the compiler had been looking at just this expression on its own, it would have said that's an array of constructor infos. It's an array of constructor infos. It's not an array of member infos. But because we've provided a target context, which is member info, then it's telling it that each individual element should be cast as a member info. So it's treating this array as an array of member infos, and that works better. Also, if this had been a completely empty thing, then that would have been a disaster, because if we interpreted this array literal in its own right, on its own, what type would it have had if it was just nothing like that? Well, in option strict on, cannot infer an element type, an object strict on does not allow objects to be assumed. And if we didn't have option strict on, then that would just be an array of objects. And that really would not work. We really needed it to be an array of the correct type. Okay, so what I've done here is I've shown you, firstly, a really beautiful way. When you start deciding to put immutable data collections into your own data types, then you can explore with these kinds of array literals in order to make as beautiful an API as you can think of for it. Array literals, I mean, they're weird. You think they're just the stupidest thing ever, but I find myself using them in every single day of my programming life, and it's just a silly thing. It's one of the things I love about this new version of Visual Basic. Okay, change of gear. I'm not going to talk about any more array literals. I'm going to talk about lambdas. Actually, I need to tell you about something else first. Imagine this was the situation 4 weeks ago. We've almost finished coding Visual Studio 2010. It's right at the end of development. You can imagine that we're in the escrow period. That means that they need to have the product stable for a period of a few weeks, just so we can test that, so no one's adding in new fixes, because every time someone fixes a bug in it, it resets the period, and we have to have another 2 weeks when we don't make any changes. So any bug that we find is very serious, and it goes straight to the very highest levels of .NET review war room, they call it. These are the team of 15 architects who sit around the table, and every new bug, they comes in and says, okay, we see that it's a bug, but it's not serious enough for us to delay the release of Visual Studio 10. So we got a bug here. The bug we got, it was to do with an old legacy Visual Basic function, file open. How many of you have used file open? Yeah? Where was it? File open of 1, a.text, open mode dot input. Yeah, that sort of thing from the old days of Visual Basic 6. Actually, in Visual Basic 6, they used to write, can't remember, from as input or something like that. I forget the syntax. The situation was that in Visual Basic 6, they have these integer numbers, and these integers are associated with open files on a per assembly basis. That made sense from VB6 days. It meant that if one VBX or OCX component opened a file, it didn't affect the other file number one that was opened by another thing. And this moved into Visual Basic.NET. It means that when one assembly opens number one, then another assembly opens number one, then they're different. Now, we had a trouble here. How do you know which assembly opened it? Well, fortunately, there's a beautiful function that we could use when we implemented file open called get, where is it, system dot, I can't remember where it is. And this returns a system.reflection.assembly. So what I'm thinking there, oh, the way we implemented file open is inside our implementation of file open, it just calls get calling assembly to find who was the calling assembly, to associate integer one with that calling assembly. There's a trouble here. When we implemented it in the first Visual Basic.NET, it worked fine. under our hood, they changed the JIT compiler so that get calling assembly no longer works. It no longer works for three reasons. First reason, inlining. Second reason, tail recursion optimization. Third reason, more inlining. What happens is that now the JIT engine, it says, okay, you have a function here, and it calls a sub-function here. This one had a stack frame where it kept all of its local variables. This new function is going to have a new stack frame where it keeps its local variables. Hey, we don't need to waste two stack frames. We could merge this one into this one. Just reuse the same stack frame, and that will make it easier. So we're going to reuse the same stack frame from the user's code as for the file open call. And when we try to discover get calling assembly, it doesn't show our calling assembly here, it shows the one up here. What that means is that whenever you use get calling assembly, it has the strong potential to yield the wrong answer. And what we found was that, oh, the problem was even worse on the 64-bit machine. If you run something like this on a 64-bit machine, sometimes it resulted in silent data loss. Sometimes it resulted in just an exception being thrown at runtime. Sometimes it resulted in something as stupid as when you do message box. Right, do this yourself. I don't know if you've ever noticed. Make a WinForms app, put on a button, handle the button click by doing message box, the VB message box function. Of course, when you run message box, it's supposed to print the name of your executable up the top. Let's make it a bit longer. Hello there to the Netherlands. Console application VB. If you put this inside the event handler, inside a button click, it prints the wrong caption. It prints system.windows.forms as the caption. Okay, that was due to this stupid inlining problem. Anyway, we come to the shiproom 4 weeks ago, and they say, what on earth is this about? And you tell them, look, because the JIT compiler has just become more aggressive, 2 months ago it had just become more aggressive, we discover that the old legacy functions now have the potential to cause silent data loss. Okay, you can imagine, they said, that's good enough, that meets the bar, we will reset the escrow period and delay by 1 or 2 days the release. Anyway, we got the fix in. What that meant was, I hate legacy functions. File open, just, I wish we could have got rid of it. We couldn't get rid of it because there are too many people using it. Pretty much every single person in the world who started with VB6 and upgraded to VB.net has still got a file open in their code. That's why we left it behind. Anyway, that's where we were 1 month ago, and I'm really glad that we're out of it now. I wanted to do something with lambdas. Making a very small program, all it does is makes a web request. It fetches the content of Lucian. This is my blog page. It gets the response stream, and it reads to the end. This code doesn't work in Silverlight. The reason it doesn't work is that it's synchronous. The word synchronous, it means it blocks until the result is finished. Silverlight doesn't let you do synchronous things. Actually, synchronous means that the thread that we're doing it on is blocked until the result is ready. In other words, the thread is just waiting around. And if you're writing a desktop application and you want to do one blocking operation, you might as well spawn a separate thread to do the blocking operation and then continue with your main one. And if you want to retrieve web pages, if you want to retrieve 1,000 web pages at a time, you might as well create 1,000 threads to do it. Well, you probably shouldn't. That's because in Windows, every thread takes how much memory? 1 megabyte of memory. If you've created 1,000 threads, you're using a gigabyte not to do anything at all, just to wait around for the threads. And that's a complete waste. If you're doing this in an ASP service, it's an even bigger disaster. Imagine the ASP is already handling 1,000 requests concurrently, maybe not 1,000, several hundred requests concurrently. And if each one of these creates 100 threads, then already that's wasted 2 gigabytes not to do anything at all. A complete disaster. Okay, so the standard answer is that we all have to use asynchronous programming in what we do. Hands up, how many of you are using asynchronous programming? Most of you. How many of you would use it more if it were easier to use? Yeah, the same number. The fact is, asynchronous programming is a real dog to write. And the best we can do at the moment is lambdas. Actually, this is more or less how we're doing it in Visual Studio 2008. We do web.begin_get_response. We pass the address of the callback, and the callback gets this iasync result, and it has this hideous C type here. We might use direct cast because we like using direct cast. Why do we like using direct cast? Because direct cast doesn't do any reinterpretation. It will only ever cast the thing if it can be. It will never turn a string into an integer or something goofy like that. And we look at this and we think this is really ugly code. And now with Visual Studio 2010, we're all going to rewrite our address of into using lambdas. Okay, what used to be a separate callback, I've now put inside this multi-line lambda inside the body. And you've all been using single-line lambdas, I'm sure, for 2008. Now with 2010, we get multi-line lambdas. And the advantage here is that we no longer need that stupid direct cast. That's because the web variable has already been accessible from the context. It waits for the response, it gets the stream, and it writes it. I can't run it because I haven't got the network connection working correctly. Multi-line lambdas, why do we like this? We like multi-line lambdas because it was awful spaghetti code before when we had the callback in a separate top-level function. It means the guy who's reviewing our code has a bigger conceptual burden looking at all of the top-level functions declared in our class. He's asking, what does this one do? What does callback do? And he has to, in his head, construct a spaghetti graph saying, where is all the possible callers of this callback function in order to do a high-quality code review? With these multi-line lambdas, we've put it in place where it belongs with access to the variables that it needs, and this has now become the way that we think that we should all be writing callbacks, unless they become super long, in which case, yeah, factor them out as always. Multi-line lambdas. Multi-line lambdas are also part of our co-evolution promise with VB and C Sharp. What we see in this release is the task parallel library is coming out as really the preferred way to write code that takes advantage of multi-core. Task parallel library is using lambdas throughout. We had to introduce multi-line lambdas into Visual Basic in order to let you guys, the Visual Basic users, use the task parallel library effectively. And there we have it. You're not shut out of the task parallel library. Multi-line lambdas. Dim f equals function. If random number is above 0.5, then return 1, else return 2.5. What is the return type of this function? It's a double, yeah. Using exactly the same principle as before, lambdas use dominant type algorithm to find the return type. Let's put option strict on here. And of course, if I tried to return a string, then it will be an error because more than one type is possible. Consider using as to specify the type. As object. And that works fine because we can convert an integer to an object and we can convert a string to an object. There's a bug in Visual Basic that we did not have time to let the war room fix. I want this function to return an integer array, and that's fine. But if I decided to make it return a double array, then in your heads you're telling me, wait a minute, this should work, because 3 and 4, it should take the target type double array and use that as the way we interpret the thing. But it doesn't work. This was a bug that we couldn't get fixed. The return statement is the only place... Sounds stupid when I say it. The return statement inside a function does not take the target type into account when looking at array literals. That's the only place where we fail to get the array literal stuff working. And I feel really stupid for it, but there we have it. What it means, unfortunately, is that even things as stupid as this don't work. Can you tell me why this doesn't work? Let's fix that up. Why does this one not work? Answer. It's looking at this array in isolation. In isolation, what is the type of this array? If it doesn't know what the target type of this array is, it's just an object array. And you cannot convert an object array to a double array. So we had to do that. This is a bit weird. Dominant type. I'm sorry, I keep going back to dominant type, but dominant type, I think, is something that's really important to get used to. What is the dominant type between, let's make this simple, what is the dominant type between nothing and a double 3.5? Answer. Double. The reason is, nothing does not participate at all in calculating the dominant type. It can't. I mean, nothing doesn't really tell you what type we're looking for. Whenever it finds a nothing, it says, we'll skip over this, and we'll only pay attention to what everyone else said when we're calculating the dominant type. Okay, there we have it. We have lambdas and dominant type. And there's one last thing I wanted to talk to you about today. Dynamic. And Anders talked about dynamic in his keynote. Dynamic was a difficult thing to implement properly. Dynamic, as Anders said, it sits upon the dynamic language runtime. And we have this very delicate dance, really, between the language and the dynamic language runtime. The language wants to do some dynamic operation, and it's asking, hey, we have this philosophy, object is king. The object is the most important factor in saying how a dynamic method should behave. So if you have a Python object and you invoke a method on it in Python, it will behave how Python objects behave with respect to overload resolution and types and blah, blah, blah. But if you have a .NET object and you do a late bound call to it, it will behave how VB tells it to behave. If you're in C-sharp and you have a .NET object and you invoke it, it will behave how C-sharp tells it to behave. So in all, the dynamic language runtime is based upon these complicated protocol dances. The language says, hey, can you do this? It says no. It goes back and says, can you do this? Da, blah, blah, blah. It goes backwards and forwards. And there are a lot of edge cases because of the complexity of this dance. So far, we haven't done a good enough job of writing up the detailed specifications of how the dance works. And when you guys start using dynamic in your code, you're going to have to be learning about these edge cases. I don't actually know if it's worth it. I mean, dynamic, yeah, it was super useful for IronPython to be released. It was super useful for C-sharp because C-sharp is calling COM binding through its through dynamic. VB has always had office interop. It's always had COM binding. It's always had its own COM binder, and it still uses it. So the places where you, as VB people, will be using dynamic will be first if you want to write objects whose which change as they go along, like they dynamically get new properties and methods added to them. And that can be quite neat. You can use it in WPF binding. You can create a dynamic object. You can dynamically add properties, add fields to it, and WPF will bind to those dynamically created properties. It doesn't work with serialization. Dynamic is a mixed bag. We don't really know if dynamic will be big or not, but if it is big, then you'll have to know how to use it. And here's part of it. Here I've created a new bag. Bag is a class that I defined. It inherits from dynamic object. Internally, it has a dictionary of strings, integers. So internally, it's going to maintain this map. This is what Anders was doing. A map of properties and values. Here, when I assign o.x equals 15, it's a dynamic object. So it calls try set member, and the implementation that I wrote will add an entry into that dictionary with the value. In other words, once we write this, it's going to end up with the three values. If I set a breakpoint here and run it, it hits the breakpoint when we set the x thing. The dance is complicated. Public property x as integer equals 15. Ha! Using a new feature of 2010, these are auto-implemented properties. They're wonderful. All of the time, you used to have to write this getter and the setter down here, and it was all boilerplate code. Now with 2010, we don't need the boilerplate code. If it's just a simple getter and setter, then it works as it is. Now, this is a bit of a mystery. What's it going to do? O.x equals 15. Is this going to set the .NET object, or is it going to call into the DLR attempt? There's no way I expect you to know the answer. This is all part of the dance, and it depends on how we made the dance. If I run this with the debugger, it still goes here. And it goes there with fields again. Wait a minute. You're right. Let's just print o.x. Sorry, I was wondering, why isn't this doing what I thought it was going to do? If I run this, it has the value 15. I'm sorry. I'll set the breakpoint here. I'll run it. It's doing the Y, and it's doing the Z, but it's not doing the X. I told you it had this complicated dance. I knew I was getting somewhere there. Thanks for telling me what was wrong. The dance with dynamic object is even more complicated. The dance says, object is king. Therefore, if this thing has a .NET thing of the right name, then we're going to use that first. If it doesn't, we're going to fall into the DLR. So the dance now says, if you have a dot member here, then I'll use it. Otherwise, I'll fall into the DLR. Otherwise, for normal stuff, it falls back into .NET again. God, it's complicated. There's one final place that's a bit confusing. Let's see. Suppose I wanted O.x to behave a bit like a string. Let's say I wanted to be able to do O and hello, something like that. Let's suppose, I don't know why, there are lots of objects that you want them to behave a bit like a string. I'm out of time, I'm just going to finish this. Well, public override function try-convert. That's one way that we're going to do it, overriding the try-convert method, which will try to convert it into a string. Another place that we could do it is public overrides function toString, which is the normal .NET thing. And the other way to do it is implements iComparable. Sorry, I don't mean iComparable. I mean implements iConvertible. Get typecode. Okay, we've seen the three different ways of possibly converting to string. And the answer is, this is completely non-obvious and it's part of this dance. We have to do all of them. That is, if C# has a dynamic object D and it assigns it to a string, it will use this try-convert part of the DLR dance. If you try to concatenate it, it will use toString. Visual Basic, if you just assign it to a string, it will use iConvertible. If you use C type dynamic will be new to you. C type dynamic is a new thing that we've introduced. It uses dynamic conversions to convert stuff, okay, like its name says. It uses try convert, and if we try to concatenate it, it uses iConvertible. Why am I telling you this? Because DLR, we don't know if it's the future or not, but if it is, then you'll have to know how to do it properly. And it's completely non-obvious how to do it properly, especially in this case. You'd write it, you'd do a test with just one of them and it would work, but it wouldn't work on the other case and it wouldn't work for C#. Or if you did it in C#, it wouldn't work for VB. Okay, now you guys know how to do a string thing with a dynamic object. That's just one tiny part of the dance. There's a heck of a lot more dances, and we're going to be documenting them in the coming months. That's everything. I've told you why I'm proud to be a VB, why I've loved some of the new features we've introduced, and I've shown you some pretty slick ways to use array literals, and I've told you the deep down stuff on dominant type and type inference and context and superposition types and the nothing literal. And when your coworkers get a bug with nullable types and nothing, and you go in there and you fix it up, they'll think you're geniuses. Thank you.